Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
On this Super Tuesday, 2016, does your right to vote give you as much impact as a fellow citizen prepared to make a large campaign contribution? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As we await results of primary elections in 12 states, including Texas, it's worth considering how a democracy like the United States has allowed money to play such a pivotal role in who gets elected and what gets done in government. My guest concedes that we will never entirely remove money from politics, but he believes if Americans understand the extent to which major donors pull the strings of the candidates they bankroll, we will be motivated to change a system increasingly set up to benefit those wealthy political patrons. Nick Penniman is executive director of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. His new book, written with co-author Wendell Potter, is called Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Nick, welcome to Think.
Hey, thank you so much.
You note that a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats are outraged by the current system of campaign finance. Why has that disapproval not been enough to spark change?
Well, we haven't brought our collective power to Washington or the state capitals yet. But it's true that this is an issue that grabs nearly everyone. There was a poll done by the New York Times recently, and 84% of Americans believe that money plays too much a role in politics, and they want the system completely overhauled. Another poll done by Pew Research Center recently had a striking number in it, which was 76 and 76. 76% of Democrats said that they think money has more power than ever over politics, and 76% of the Republicans said exactly the same thing. It's one of these incredibly rare instances in an otherwise very polarized electorate in which the public seems to be gelling around this problem.
It's worth pointing out that in the aggregate, the two major party spending tends to be pretty equal from one election to the next. I wonder if average voters are inclined to believe that their favorite party is somehow better about clean campaign funding than their opponents.
Oh, I think so. I think the if you're a Republican, you typically say the Democratic Party is controlled by union money. And if you're a Democrat, you say the Republican Party is controlled by oil, you know, money, by ExxonMobil, places like that. But the truth is that there is parity in spending. The sources of the money are sometimes different in the parties. It's true that Republicans actually do receive more from extractive industries like oil and coal. But it's also true that both parties receive a lot of the money from the same sources, primarily from banks and pharmaceutical companies, healthcare companies. So there's a lot of overlap there. And, you know, if you're a smart political donor who's lobbying or working on the behalf of special interests, you're going to fund the members of the relevant committees in Washington that you need to get stuff done with. And you're going to fund Republicans and Democrats both.
It should come as no surprise that money has always been a part of American politics. But I'll confess, I was a little depressed to read that George Washington, father of our country, was not above plying voters with liquor.
I know. I was disappointed to find that, too. It's true. But listen, it's never, never been as bad as it is today. The only time that was maybe comparable to this was the era of the robber barons, the big trusts that Teddy Roosevelt busted up. They were playing pretty hard in elections, too. But the numbers, really then kind of subsided, and the power subsided because we actually passed laws in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s that knocked down that power. And then starting in the mid-70s and then coming to kind of a crescendo right now, what we've seen is this massive resurgence in the assertion of money over the political system. And I'll give you a couple statistics just to back that up. When John Kennedy was elected president, there were 250 registered lobbyists in Washington. Today, there are 12,000 registered lobbyists in Washington. Collectively, those lobbyists disclosed last year more than $3 billion in spending. That's just what they had to disclose. Now, $3 billion is about $1 billion more than it actually costs to run Congress. When Ronald Reagan ran for re-election in 1984, he went to, ready for this, two fundraisers, two. When Barack Obama ran for re-election in 2012, he attended more than 200 fundraisers.
Wow.
members of Congress 20 years ago said that they would spend 10 to 15% of their time raising money. They now say that they spend about 50% of their time raising money. And I'd love to talk with you about that during this hour, because I think that that's one of the things that is least reported, but is in a way the biggest problem.
Absolutely. And, let me jump in or continue,
yeah,
and then
sure.
We'll get to that.
No. And then, you know, so in terms of just aggregate spending, the 2000 election cycle was a $3 billion election cycle. This year's cycle is expected to be a $10 billion election cycle. We can go on and on. But what you see, what you really seen in the last two decades is that the, you know, if we were at a stage one cancer, let's say, in the 1990s, we're now at stage four. Hmm. And so the point that we're trying to make in the book is that, yes, money in politics has played a role throughout the history of our country because power always tries to enact itself on the system. But we truly believe that at this point we're at a tipping point, we're at a crossroads where this either has to be dealt with or the consequences for the future of the country will be severe.
But it seems as if the people in the position to make the changes are also the people in the position to benefit from leaving things as they are.
Of course. And that was the case. It's the case with almost any issue you could think of, right? But it certainly was the case during abolition and during suffrage and during the civil rights movement, where it was much more to the benefit of the people in power to keep those systems in place. And so, we can't underestimate the amount of power that it's going to take to clean up this current system. It's going to take a lot of people power. But I got to say, too, that we have talked to a number of former members of Congress. And in fact, an organization that I run called Issue One has recruited 125 former U.S. senators, House members, and governors, Republicans and Democrats alike, all of whom have agreed that we are at a crisis. So I think what you're seeing is that people inside the system itself and who really understand it know that something's got to give.
You reproduce a little graphic in the book that is going to stay with me. It is the model daily schedule given to freshman House Democrats to help them manage their time. And presumably Republicans get something similar. But in a 10-hour day, it suggests 2 hours in committee meetings or on the House floor, 1 to 2 hours of constituent visits, an hour of what's called recharge time. I don't know exactly what that is. Lunch, maybe. An hour of strategic outreach, and 4 hours of call time. Tell us what call time is.
So call time. So this is really insidious. Call time is dialing for dollars. And they can do it in a couple different ways. What they cannot do is they can't make any of these fundraising phone calls from their congressional offices. So they either need to make them off campus or they've got to make them from one of the townhouses, probably owned by one of the trade associations that they're friendly with near the Capitol building. Or typically what they do is they go to the DNC or RNC headquarters. And once they're there, they are assigned a cubicle, a little white cubicle normally, and they're given a stack of call sheets, a couple inches thick, and then a can of soda and maybe a cheap sandwich. And they put their headsets on, just like you would if you worked for a call center at AT&T or for Target, and they sit for 4 hours at a time, and they dial for dollars with rich people, most of whom they will never meet, and almost all of whom live outside their districts. And it's the same 10, 15, 20,000 rich people who get called all the time. You know, we talked to a lot of political donors in this book, and they said that they— some of them actually have set up dummy phone numbers for senators and House members to call because they're so sick of getting the calls. Some of these donors are getting 5 or 6 different fundraising phone calls a day. So it's, you know, it is demeaning. It is demoralizing. It is taking them away from the jobs that they're supposed to be doing. But it's necessary because of what I said earlier about how big the numbers have gotten. The cash haul is so significant these days that they have no choice but to do this.
So they need that money. It does sound horrible. It's also horrible, I'm sure, to get those calls. But I would imagine that it doesn't just go, "Hello, Jane Q. Rich person. I am Senator so-and-so, Congressman so-and-so, and I would like some money." Are there promises made? What are they discussing issues? Does Jane Q. Citizen say, "Super, and here are the 3 things that I really care about as I write you a $25,000 check"?
Well, wouldn't you?
I mean, I don't have $25,000.
You've got a U.S. senator on the other end of the line. I think inevitably these people are talking about the things that they would like to see happen in the system. And, you know, whether that's tax breaks or whether that's ambassadorship, actually under Barack Obama, the highest number of political donors have now been appointed ambassadors than any under any other president. So I think that they're definitely asking for something. But listen, even if they aren't, it's marinating the brains and mindsets of our elected officials, our employees, in the lives of the wealthiest among us. And I'll give you a really almost petty or mundane example of this. We were talking to a female member of Congress, Democrat, and we asked her about the call time thing. And she said, oh my God, yeah, I just can't stand it. And she said, you know, it's probably because I'm a woman. I get in these ridiculous conversations with people that have absolutely nothing to do with national policy or politics or the future of the country. And I said, well, give me an example. And she said, okay. She said, I was trying to get a hold of this Hollywood executive to ask him for $2,700, which is the current max out, what's called hard money limit. And I ended up getting his wife on the phone. And so she picked up the phone and I said, hello, my name is Congresswoman so-and-so. And I'm really interested. And boom, right when she said, I'm really interested, the woman on the other end of the phone, the donor, said, oh, my God, I'm so glad that someone called. I got to tell you, I ordered these curtains for my home. They were supposed to be kind of a lemony yellow, but they're like a mustard color. And it's just the worst thing ever. It's wrecked my day. I can't believe this. I'm sure this happens to you all the time. And so here you are with a member of Congress who has to get into a 5, 6, 7 minute conversation with some wealthy woman in Hollywood about the color of her curtains, just so that she can get to the point of saying, well, actually what I called about is that I'm hoping you can make a contribution of $2,700 to my reelection campaign. But it just shows you, you know, it just shows you that this is what we're doing to these people. We are forcing them to engage with the wealthiest among us who can write those $2,700 checks, and taking them away from talking to each other and developing legislation and crafting great ideas and reaching out to their constituents.
What about people who have great ideas or, you know, passions, things that they really think need to be addressed by their member of Congress but don't have $2,700?
I think it is almost impossible for them to get a hearing. And actually, there was a study done. I cannot remember by which universities, but two universities teamed up about a year ago. And they got a bunch of people to call members of Congress. Some of the people who called were actual donors and others weren't. So they did a kind of a, you know, a blind study. And they found out that, of course, as you can imagine, the donors got almost all of their calls returned. And the people who were just regular people got none of their calls returned. So there's actually some studies that have shown exactly what everyone would guess, which is that if you're just a regular citizen, you don't get a whole lot back.
My guest is Nick Penniman. He's executive director of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund and has a new book out called Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email us at think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the executive director of Issue One, Nick Penniman. His new book, written with Wendell Potter, is called Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Nick, I want to talk about this. There's also the issue of people who have really just enormous amounts of money to spend, calling together a number of potential candidates and essentially making them jump through hoops to demonstrate that they might be worthy of a big chunk of cash.
Yeah, this is being called the wealth primary. And one of the best examples of it is the Koch family network, Charles and David Koch, the industrialist heirs. They hold annual retreats with a bunch of other donors and ask the candidates to come before them. It's ultimately a group of maybe 100 or so people. And getting a ticket to a Koch event is, you know, is a golden ticket for a lot of these candidates. So they go and they do their spiel with these wealthy candidates, and then with the wealthy donors, and then the donors help decide who's going to make it and who's not going to make it. Now, the Koch network in this cycle has promised to spend $900 million affecting the elections. $900 million in one way or another. That is more than the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee will spend combined. So what you're seeing with the rapid rise of centimillionaire and billionaire interventions in the elections is essentially the displacement of the two parties and their structures. And it's not even the outsourcing of it. It's the destruction of it. It's the undermining of those party structures. And so someone could say, well, so what? You know, it's still wealthy people, and I'm sure wealthy people control the parties anyway. Well, actually, that's not true, first of all. And then second of all, there's an important role that the DNC and RNC play in the political dialogue, which is they do actually moderate the dialogue. They have brands to protect. They don't want people to go out there and say crazy stuff on their behalf. But when you all of a sudden have all these massive independent groups and networks and independent expenditures occurring, which is what we're seeing more and more of these days, you've got, you know, radical fly-by-night groups like Americans for a Better Tomorrow. They set up shop a year before the election, raise a ton of money, and then the day after the election, they collapse their tent and they're gone. And they feel no obligation to the future. They feel no obligation to the party. And they're willing to say the most ridiculous and hurtful and fallacious stuff that they can about these politicians. So it's part of what's radicalizing the dialogue in this country and creating this massive political polarization that we're seeing.
Where does unspent money go when a candidate pulls out before, you know, a primary candidate decides that a run is not worth pursuing anymore?
Well, that's a good question, and the FEC hasn't entirely figured that out yet. In fact, there are a bunch of kind of cases before them to ask what these candidates can do with the dough. Most of the time, they keep it in their PACs because they want to be able to dole it out to other politicians and continue to curry favor within the political system. But some of them ask whether or not they can take a trip around the world with their families with the money. And so far, the FEC, again, hasn't really ruled on that stuff.
Has that actually happened?
Not as far as that I know, that specific one. But I tell you what, some of the trips that politicians take are quite extravagant, and they are typically funded by the industries that they're supposed to be regulating. I mean, it's ski trips to Aspen and, you know, golfing trips to Hilton Head. And they're you and I would feel like we were living in the lap of luxury if we went on one of these trips.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Yes. Question I have is a rather simple one. The massive need for money today, is it partially driven by the radical gerrymandering that's going on in the very strange shapes of many congressional districts, especially House districts?
Well, in a weird way, it's quite the opposite, because when you have only 10% of the congressional districts that are truly competitive today, which is the kind of consensus number, 10% are truly competitive. Those in the non-competitive districts need less money. What they need is don't mess with me money, as they call it. So they, if you live in a non-competitive district and you don't want a primary challenger, you raise enough money and you just hold it in your war chest so that anyone who would think about running against you is intimidated by that. Others who are in non-competitive districts will raise some money, again, to give it away to members of their party so that they can curry favor to gain leadership roles within the party to kind of buy their way to the top. But increasingly, what you find is that the bulk of the money is being spent in those 10%, just in the same way that in the presidential election, the bulk of the money is being spent in a dozen or so battleground states, and all the other states are irrelevant.
We hear the figures discussed and different numbers are given, but there's a very small number of American families that seem to be providing like the lion's share of money that goes into some of these elections. Can you tell us what you know about that?
Yeah, the one that that actually shocked me when I read it in the New York Times 2 months ago is that 158 families in America have supplied half of the campaign cash in the presidential election cycle so far. And when you hear a number like that, you really have to ask the fundamental question that we ask in the book, which is our system essentially becoming an oligarchy? You know, of course we can vote, but many of us are voting in non-competitive races. And of course we can petition Congress and call our members of Congress and write letters to them. But in all functionality, when you have 158 families who are bankrolling the whole scene, then is that an oligarchy? And a friend of ours named Mark McKinnon, who's a good Texan, and you guys probably know him, he was the communications director for George W. Bush, and he lives in Austin, wrote in the Daily Beast about 6 months ago that, in fact, we are becoming an oligarchy.
So one of the things that you think is really important is that people understand the way this affects them at sort of the kitchen table level, because we can hear those numbers and hear the word oligarchy and think, well, it's all happening on this higher plane, but I'm going to vote based on the issues that matter to me. There have been policies that can be pretty directly linked to the activity of money within campaigns. Can you talk about, let's just talk about money in politics and the rise in obesity in America.
Sure. So the report that we point to in the book, that is a stunning report and meticulously done, was a six-month report by Reuters, the Reuters news agency. They looked into the last 10 years of attempts by local and state and governments and also the federal government to reduce the obesity rate in America. And as many of your listeners probably know, obesity is one of the fastest rising public health diseases in the country right now. Type 2 diabetes is pervasive. So just to kind of back up a sec, here we are. We've got this public health problem in this country. One of the things you do with public health problems is you create a government reaction to them so that they don't spread and so it doesn't cost all of us taxpayers a lot more money down the road in Medicare and Medicaid costs. But what Reuters looked at the attempts to legislate anti-obesity policy into law, what they concluded is that in every single battle they looked at, the fast food, corn, because of high fructose corn syrup, and sugar industries won every one of those battles. They were able to kneecap and shut down every one of those attempts to legislate. So here we are, and we've got this problem that continues to snowball, and we have no official response to it because we can't get that response over the end zone. The other ones that, you know, that I think we should point to are with Dodd-Frank, for instance. Mm-hmm. So here we are. We've got the a financial crisis that nearly collapsed the global economy. And we did pass Dodd-Frank. But when Gretchen Morgenson, who is the chief financial reporter for The New York Times, was asked whether or not we actually solved the problem, she said absolutely not, because we couldn't deal with the big stuff. And when she was asked, and the big stuff, of course, being separating commercial investment banking, reinstalling the Glass-Steagall Act, et cetera, et cetera. When asked why, she said it's very simple. She said because the banks have hundreds of lobbyists in Washington and the American people have none. The other one that I would point to is pharmaceutical pricing. You know, we all saw the kind of sausage making, the very ugly sausage making of Obamacare. One of the things that was never even discussed as part of Obamacare was using the power of the government to bulk bargain to reduce the cost of drug prices, especially for people who are on Medicare and Medicaid. Every other country in the world does this, by the way. Every other country bulk bargains to reduce the cost to save taxpayers' money. The first thing that Obama did when he decided to take on health care is he dispatched Rahm Emanuel, who's now, as you guys know, the mayor of Chicago and was then the chief of staff, to the pharmaceutical industry. And Rahm said, here's the deal. We know that you guys are too tough to take on and you have too much power in Washington. So we're going to give you total immunity on drug pricing. And in exchange for that, we expect you to back Obamacare. And that was the deal that was struck. So here we are. And healthcare costs have continued to rise, and pharmaceutical pricing is a huge piece of that. So you can go down the line. I mean, virtually anything that you talk about, it, with the quality of the air we breathe, the safety of our food, all of that is being affected by policymaking or the lack of policymaking in Washington, which is all being deeply manipulated by the lobbyists and the donors who are coin-operating the government. And so, you know, one of the big points that we make in the book is that whether you love government or hate government or somewhere in between, the point is that the government is us. And either we will take control of it again and the government will begin working on behalf of the common good, or the special interests will continue to take control of it and it will work primarily for their benefit.
You admit here that lobbying in its purest form is important to a healthy democracy. What would change about lobbying if the money were strictly limited or removed altogether?
Well, it'd be the right kind of lobbying. It'd be exactly what we think of or what we would want with lobbying, which is exchanging information, making arguments. Sure, of course, showing up to congresspeople's offices and sitting down with them and trying to convince them that you're right. But let's take the money out of it. And they did exactly that in South Carolina back in the 1990s after a huge scandal where lobbyists were paying to play left and right. They passed a law that said if you are a registered lobbyist in the state of South Carolina, then you have announced the fact that you have business to do with the government, that you're grinding an axe with the government, and therefore when you add money to the equation, it looks like bribery and it gives you an unfair advantage. So they completely severed the tie between lobbying and money. Lobbyists are not allowed to make political contributions. And by the way, that's a conservative state, as many of your listeners know. And the very conservative state Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of that law for 20 years now.
I want to talk about Citizens United, this 2010 Supreme Court ruling that you compare with crop spraying gasoline onto a wildfire. It started with this film that portrayed Hillary Clinton in a negative light. How did that end up? A case over this end up prohibiting federal restrictions on political spending by individuals and corporations?
Yeah, so I think Citizens United has been a horribly reported story by the press. The press attributes almost everything that's wrong with our campaign finance system today to Citizens United, and so do most of the political candidates out there. But it was actually a much more narrow decision at its core. And as you said, there was a movie called Hillary the Movie. It was being sponsored by a conservative nonprofit organization/corporation called Citizens United. According to the McCain-Feingold laws, and McCain-Feingold was passed in 2002, independent groups could not run political ads within 60 or 90 days of an election, depending upon what kind of election it was. Well, the Citizens United group wanted to air its movie about Hillary within 60 days of an election, within 60 days of the Democratic primary. And the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, said that they couldn't do it because it was an act of electioneering and therefore they couldn't air it. Well, Citizens United sued the FEC and ultimately went up to the Supreme Court and they won. And what the Supreme Court said was that those types of infringements on corporations were dangerous because they would suppress key voices in the course of a debate in our democracy, and therefore corporations should be allowed to spend what they want to in the context of elections. Now, that ruling in and of itself is not terribly bad. I mean, you've got to realize the NRA is a corporation. It's a nonprofit corporation. The Sierra Club is a nonprofit corporation. So we already have kind of established the notion that corporate spending is not a terrible thing in election cycles. What then happened, though, about a year later, was a lower court issued a ruling in a case called Speech Now, and that was the dangerous one. So what Speech Now said is that, based on the logic of Citizens United, if spending is an act of speech, then giving should be an act of speech. Giving money should be an act of speech, and therefore giving to independent groups, not to directly to the candidates' campaigns, but to independent groups, should be unlimited, because speech should be unlimited. That is the very case, Speech Now, that actually created super PACs, what we see today, where you've got Sheldon Adelson and major donors pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into these super PACs. But again, I want to say that at its core, Citizens United was not the boogeyman that many have made it out to be.
But super PACs can give directly or do things that directly benefit individual candidates.
Correct, and they're not supposed to. And this gets to the fact that the Federal Election Commission is completely dysfunctional and asleep at the wheel. Super PACs are not supposed to be dedicated to a single candidate, and there's supposed to be no coordination between super PACs and individual campaigns. Unfortunately, both of those things are occurring. They are dedicated almost entirely to single candidates, like Right to Rise, which was Jeb Bush's super PAC, and the coordination that they're doing is public. I mean, they literally will tweet or post online what they're going to do and say, and so will the candidates' campaigns. And they claim that because they're publishing that information online, they're not coordinating, but of course it's coordination.
We're speaking this hour with Issue One Executive Director Nick Penniman. His new book is called Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Live Super Tuesday coverage starts tonight at 7 on KERA Radio. We'll have national reports from NPR and a look at local races from the KERA news staff. On KERA TV, watch for the PBS NewsHour Super Tuesday special starting at 10 o'clock tonight. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5555.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Issue One Executive Director Nick Penniman. He has been a co-founder and director of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, and he has a new book out called Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Nick, do state and local governments have any power to regulate around Citizens United?
Well, because Citizens United was the Supreme Court, there's no way that they can go back against the core of the ruling. But there's an enormous amount that can be done despite Citizens United. And let me just lay out a couple of those things. So number one, we could, if we had the political power to do it or the movement to do it, we could enact full citizen funding, small donor incentives, public financing, whatever you want to call it, of campaigns tomorrow. And they did that in New York City a number of years ago. They created incentives for small donors to give money to politics. And right now, the bulk of the money that is spent in New York City politics is given by people who are giving $50 or less. What that's done to New York City politics is that instead of the candidates focusing on getting dinners with the rich people on the Upper East Side and Upper West Side of Manhattan, they now instead go home to their neighborhoods and they hold barbecues as fundraisers. So it reconnects them with the people. You could do that tomorrow at the federal level for every member of Congress if we had the power to do it. Number two, we could pass the same law that they passed in South Carolina, in which says that if you're a registered lobbyist in Washington, if you're one of the 12,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, you can no longer give money to politicians because it looks like a conflict of interest. It looks like you're buying their votes. It looks like corruption. Number three, we could do total, complete, and immediate transparency of all political money posted online within 24 hours. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do this. And then finally, we could fix the Federal Election Commission. We could put a really good cop on the beat. Right now, it is mired in partisanship and dysfunctional, and we taxpayers are wasting $65 million a year on that agency. All of that could be accomplished tomorrow. There are pieces of legislation that currently exist on Capitol Hill. None of those laws could get shot down by the Supreme Court. The key is to build the momentum to make it happen.
And how do you do that?
Well, I think that we are seeing something pretty extraordinary occur with this election cycle. If you look at what Donald Trump is saying about how he can't be bought and how much that is resonating, and if you look at what Bernie Sanders is saying about campaign finance and how it's a driver of wealth inequality in America, and if you look at Ted Cruz and the fact that he said 2 weeks ago that the one thing that he agreed with Bernie Sanders on is that lobbyists and wealthy interests run Washington. Cruz calls it the Washington cartel. And if you look at Hillary Clinton, who made this one of the four pillars of her campaign and has a very robust campaign finance reform platform, what you're seeing is that people from all walks of life are starting to emerge and agree that this is one of the things that they can agree on. The other thing that you've seen in the last 6 years since Citizens United is more than 600 anti-Citizens United resolutions passed at the city and state level. So people are rising up. They are doing whatever they can to show disgust for the system. In terms of very practical action, there are going to be probably 8 ballot initiatives this year, from Idaho to Arkansas to Washington State to South Dakota, both red and blue and purple states, to establish new campaign finance systems. And just last November, a new system was passed in Maine, one was passed in Seattle, and also in San Francisco. So, you know, I've only been involved in this cause for about 3 years now, but I've been a journalist covering money and politics and power for 15 years. And I got to say, we've never seen this kind of activity before, and we've never seen it in such a what is called cross-partisan way. I mean, most people say bipartisan, but the point is that, you know, because independents actually make up the largest percentage of the electorate right now, we've got to say cross-partisan.
All right, let's go to the phones once again. We have Ben on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Show has been great. As a millennial, which sometimes I'm proud of and sometimes I'm not, I guess my question is, considering everything you've just said, especially what you just said a moment ago, how do we, one, combat apathy towards what's going on, but also what are just some really, really practical organizations, ways to participate in being part of the solution that, you know, I can go back to my friends that I'm having drinks with tonight and say, hey, here's how we can do something.
Yeah, and there are a number of organizations that work directly in this cause and are going to be mobilizing people. My organization is called Issue One, and you can find us at issueone.org, issueone.org. We are the most cross-partisan group in this space. We appeal to everyone across the political spectrum, and we think that's crucial to actually winning this fight, is to build that cross-partisanship. So check us out, please. But there are also groups like Common Cause, which I'm sure you've heard of. The U.S. PIRGs do some work on campaign finance reform. There's a group called Every Voice, everyvoice.org out there, which is responsible for running a lot of the ballot initiatives. Also one called represent.us, Represent Us, which is a brand new group. It's growing very rapidly, and they're going to be running some ballot initiatives primarily in red states this year, which is interesting. And they've done one of the best jobs of building these lefty-righty alliances of any group out there. They built a great one down in Tallahassee a year ago, and they rammed a big piece of reform legislation through in Tallahassee, despite the fact that the Democrats didn't want it. It actually was the arrival of the Florida Tea Party that got the thing over the line. So there's a lot of energy, a lot of excitement out there right now.
Let's go back to the phones and speak with Dick in Louisville. Hi, Dick.
Hi. You know, the politicians are raising all this money, but if the primary purpose of all that money is to buy airtime, television, and radio, as I understand it, the airwaves belong to the American people, and the stations pay a license to be able to broadcast on those airwaves. So why can't we pass a law that requires television and radio stations to provide a specific amount of free broadcasting for politicians during campaigns, and they're cut back some of the funds that they need to campaign.
I totally agree, and the National Association of Broadcasters does
not. A lobbying group,
and they've been able to completely kneecap that idea in Washington for more than a decade. But I absolutely agree. Now, I don't think that that would, you know, get rid of the problem, but let's say it shaved 10% of the problem off. I think that'd be fantastic. You know, I think that the only reason why I say 10% is because even though the bulk of the money does go into TV ad buys, I think that, that what would happen is a lot of these politicians or their campaigns would take the free airtime and then they'd buy more airtime on top of that. They would just completely flood the zone even more so than they already do.
Where does the rest of that money go? I mean, I know that there are yard signs and there are events. You know, when you look at, you know, how much more will be spent for the 2016 elections than the 2012 elections, it's a little hard to fathom how you can put that much money into circulation to win a presidential race.
I know. Well, and think about how much isn't being spent on philanthropy, on good causes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, $10 billion, for God's sake. And these are people, the people who are giving that $10 billion would otherwise be giving it to libraries and churches and homeless shelters and conservation groups, right? So it's actually robbing the public good of a great deal of money on an annual basis. A lot of the money is starting to go to this permanent consultancy class, political consultancy class in Washington that is getting insanely rich off of the amount of money that's pouring in. It, you know, it used to be, I was talking to this friend of mine who's was worked with in the Bush administration, was Dick Cheney's, one of Dick Cheney's communications people. And she said, you know, Nick, when I got into politics 30 years ago, if you wanted to work on a campaign, even a presidential, you were sleeping on someone's couch. You were doing whatever. You were eating like ham sandwiches because you believed in the cause and you believed in the candidate. And yeah, you knew that if you worked hard enough for them, maybe you could get some position in the government if they won. But she didn't expect to get rich off of it. And she said, what's happened is all these people have realized they can get really rich off the scheme now. And they're making money hand over fist. I literally, Chris, had a guy in my neighborhood. I live just outside of D.C. who was probably in his late 30s at the time. He bought the most expensive house in the neighborhood, ripped off the back of it, built it out. So he probably bought it for, I don't know, $1 million, pumped another million in. And I'm standing out watching this occur one day on our street. And I said, just curiously, what do you do for a living? And he just smiled and he said, oh, I'm a political consultant. I do ad buys. And there's a 38-year-old guy. And he's worth a couple $1 million at that age just because his company, GMMB, did most of the ad buys for the Obama campaign. So there are a lot of people who are starting to skim a lot of that money right off the top so that they can lead very extravagant lives as a result.
I fear that you may laugh aloud when I ask this question, but I'm genuinely curious. It sounds like you have talked to legislators in particular who realize the system is crazy but don't quite know how to step off of it, are worn out by the fundraising. Have you met any lobbyists who also think the money is crazy and wrong? Or like, is it a barrier to entry if you believe that the money in politics is bad to becoming a lobbyist?
No, lobbyists are totally sick of this game. Because the amount of money that they need to give and they're being asked to give has so exponentially increased that they're draining their you know their education funds for their kids so that they can write these max out checks and go to these fundraisers with the politicians that they want to manipulate. Now, you know, I don't know what percent of lobbyists are sick of it, but I'd say half of them are sick of it. Half of them maybe enjoy the game or believe in the game, but half of them really think it's really odious. You know, there are people who care about causes. They're representing their clients. They want to make the arguments necessary to try to get their vision out there. But the notion of the kind of pay-to-play scheme doesn't make them feel very good. And it's costing them a lot more money every year.
Are they, with a wink and a nudge, sufficiently compensated to sort of make up for all those
yes,
donations?
Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yes, unfortunately. Yes. Most of the – if you work for a big lobbying firm – you're either given a bonus at the beginning of an election cycle or at the end. And this is not explicit, but it's implicit. You're supposed to use that bonus to write political checks.
So it's coincidental that it happens to match with however much they end up spending with politicians.
It's pretty close. Yeah, it's pretty close.
Have you gone through this thought exercise? How different would the first couple elections be if we were to radically change the way they're financed, putting power strictly in the hands of individual voters, limiting overall contributions? You know, what if, you know, the money were cut by 90%?
Well, so I don't know if you, it's really so much cutting the money as changing the source of where the money's coming from. Mm-hmm. And when I talked earlier about the New York City system, when they radically shifted the money coming from the wealthiest people on the Upper East and Upper West Sides of Manhattan to all the folks back in the boroughs, to regular folks back in the boroughs, what it does is it shifts the power structure that politics rests on. So we're not saying, this is why, you know, at the beginning of the show you said we concede that you're not going to get money out of politics. Our point is we're not trying to get money out of politics. What we need to do is shift where the money is coming from. We need to shift it from the upper 0.01% of the population and the lobbyists back to all of us. And when you shift it back to us, then the power and the shifts back to us, because the fealty and the obsession of our politicians focuses back on us again. So for me, that's the big shift that has to occur. I think transparency is important. I think that putting, you know, a cop on the beat with a better FEC is important. But ultimately, unless we shift the funding of politics back to all of us, the politicians are, you know, will be an afterthought for them, and more so each year. So what would an election look like? Well, one would hope that it would be much more substantive, A. B, our politicians would be much more focused on proposing ideas in a way that actually attracted all of us to support them. And C, you know, the whole nature of what they do with their lives would be very different. Instead of spending 4 hours a day calling wealthy people in, you know, a handful of rich cities in this country, they would be focusing on crafting email lists and web presences and social media presences that would be getting us engaged in their campaigns, so that and converting us into small donors to get the money they need to be able to run and get reelected.
In 15 seconds or less, what is it like to work at a cross-partisan organization in Washington, D.C.? Does it just feel like a dream job?
It does, because it's such an exception to the rule right now in D.C. No, people are coming out of the woodworks on this. I mean, really, it is really remarkable, and we are incredibly heartened to see so many Republicans, Democrats, Tea Party people, liberals, who are all saying, okay, we might not agree on everything, but let's all agree that we have to reclaim our fundamental system of self-government. And then we can go from there.
Nick Penniman is executive director of Issue One and co-author, along with Wendell Potter, of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Nick, thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Live Super Tuesday coverage starts tonight at 7 on KERA Radio. We'll have national reports from NPR and a look at local races from KERA news staff. On KERA Television, you can watch for the PBS NewsHour Super Tuesday special. That starts tonight at 10 o'clock. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.